Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. I have Andy, or Andrew Fisher, just depends on how you want to say his name, but Andy's on today. He is, well, he's got a hell of a background. I think almost I just need to let him quickly introduce himself to really appreciate all of what he does.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chip. It's great to be here today. A little bit about my background. Currently, I'm a third-year medical student at Texas A&M College of Medicine. But before that, I was a PA in the military. I'm still actually a PA in the Texas Army National Guard. Before I became a med student, I was a PA for about 10 years. Before that, I was a paramedic. And before that, I was just an EMT. So I've been around medicine for about 20 years, doing a variety of things, as I just said. But basically, most of my focus right now outside of medical school has been on pre-hospital trauma care.
Which means also that, Andy, this is not your first rodeo in any of these arenas. You have been doing quite a bit. And one of your big things, you actually have a little bit of a Facebook page, a little bit of website. You kind of do some stuff. Quite a bit of it's humorous, but it gets to really good information, which is why I wanted to talk to you about today is a couple of things that you've been working on. Like you said, things that you obviously enjoy. We talk a lot about resuscitation and critical care and obviously all the fun things in medicine. But sometimes when we talk about emergency medicine, we forget about the details, why certain approaches are better than others. So many of the people who are listening, Andy, are working in the same kind of setting I am. They're working in rural, remote settings. You know, maybe there's a couple of other people who work there with them, but usually we're working almost by ourselves, and we have to do a lot of things very quickly, make snap judgments. And this matters whether or not, you know, we're in the back of a truck or we're in a small ED or, you know, somewhere else, depending on where people are listening to this and what they're doing. So one of the things that comes up all the time is people want to know, what blood products should they be giving and why?
My personal preference is we should probably be utilizing low titer group O whole blood for trauma resuscitation for just three different reasons, really. So first of all, we know it doesn't make things worse. That can happen, obviously, if you're pushing crystalloids, and they can certainly cause coagulopathy, potentially acidosis, maybe some hypothermia. Second reason, it's giving back what the patient's losing, right? I mean, it's kind of intuitive that we should, if the patient's bleeding whole blood, we should probably replace it with whole blood. And thirdly, it's one product, right? So a lot of blood transfusion medicine out there, there's a lot of lore out there about how unsafe it is and everything. Well, that's mostly because a lot of the errors that happen in transfusion medicine are because of human error. And it's because we're trying to, cross-match different blood types with different blood types and ensure that everything is being exactly how this patient's blood, so we don't get any transfusion reaction. Well, it ends up that creates error. Well, if you use just one product, which is low titer O whole blood, that sort of eliminates that possibility of error. That's what I think we should do. And I know it's not available everywhere, and it might not be in something we may be able to implement throughout the country. But certainly, I think in larger facilities and maybe some of the outlying smaller hospitals, then should set up a rotating basis for their whole blood.
Now, you mentioned something I think is pretty important when we're talking about whole blood or blood products in general. What do you mean by low titer?
Oh, yeah, good question. So low titer whole blood would be defined here in the United States as you look at the immunoglobulin M, so IgM, anti-A and anti-B levels. So we want them below a certain amount. And this is based upon a lot of what came out of during World War II, where they saw that if people received whole blood that had an anti-A and anti-B titer of less than, 256, then that means they didn't really have any transfusion reaction. So I could take whole blood from one person, give it to another person, doesn't matter what the patient's blood type is, and they won't have a reaction as long as they have that low titer. The problem is this low titer isn't necessarily, there isn't a universal definition for it. Here in the United States, you see varying definitions of it. If you look down in San Antonio, they use less than 256. If you look out in Houston, they're using closer to less than 150. So it kind of varies on where you are in the country and what type of and what your blood bank is going to be using. If you go to Europe, they'll also use IgG. So it's still kind of up in the air about what is the true definition of low titer. And I don't know if we'll ever have a true consensus on what we're going to call it. But just based upon from what we saw in World War II, less than 256 on IgM, anti-A and anti-B is probably safe.
Here's another question for you that ties in with this whole blood situation and introducing it in the first place. One of the problems with whole blood is it has a shorter shelf life. So you mentioned rotating. I mean, how long is whole blood lasting us, and how often should we probably be rotating this if we're going to employ it?
Well, currently there are two different solutions that can store whole blood. We have, the CPD, which has a 21-day shelf life, and then the CPDA, which has a 35-day shelf life. So if we can get, majority of places using the CPDA, we could probably have a much longer rotation schedule for this blood. I kind of just steal what San Antonio does, and, they rotate it onto the ambulance for 14 days, and they rotate it back to the trauma center. So is it possible that, similar to how they rotate the blood out from back to the trauma center, would they go then maybe out to some of these outlying facilities to where that blood wouldn't return then? So it would just go out there and it'd either get used or would get destroyed. The problem is that there is a relatively high amount of waste with whole blood right now. Partially is because we don't have as many places using it as we could, and part of it is the cost associated with it, and not necessarily cost to the patient. It's cheaper for the patient, but it's more of a cost to the blood bank. And they don't have the ability to then fraction out that component therapy and make a little money, which helps them operate. So, there's kind of a little bit of a struggle right now on how to best implement this and get it out to further into these facilities that are more outlying, so they could be able to use it for these trauma resuscitations.
Thanks, Andy, for that great answer. Now, here's a question that's a little more tricky, and I guess it's kind of multi-part, so I'll just kind of spell it out and you can give me your thoughts on this. So classically, we're taught that, the real classic teaching is everyone gets O negative blood, right? But that's not really feasible. There's very small amounts of O negative blood available out there. So certain people who are O positive, we want to give the O positive to who are appropriate, but some people we still need to reserve the O negative for. So here's my question. Who exactly is that probably best for? I mean, the classic thing is women of childbearing age. I guess the question is, do kids, like female children, get involved with that? And then what if we don't have any O negative blood? We have to give O positive, and we find out that woman of childbearing age is a negative blood type. Can we give her a Rogam?
I think it's probably best to, like you said, probably give O negative blood to women of childbearing age, and then if you have to, just give whatever you have available. And say, you do have a female of childbearing age who ends up being O negative, you give her O positive blood. That's okay. I think moving on down the line, she has to survive this injury in order to eventually become pregnant again. So if what you have is O positive and you give it to her, she can then receive Rogam down the line. From the pediatric standpoint, that honestly, I don't know the answer to that one. So I'm going to now have something to look up for tomorrow. But yeah, I think it's give what you have. Like you said, most of the patients out there are Rh positive. So that's most likely what you're going to encounter.
Okay. And for anyone who's listening, check out the show notes, because hopefully we'll find an answer on the pediatrics. That was a hard one. I know that was a hard question because I don't know the answer to it either. I just assumed to give them O negative just because, I guess, the theoretical risk. But at the same time, some of this, a big part of this is kind of theoretical risk anyway with women at childbearing age. But so here's kind of my questions going into this. Okay. Let's say I don't have whole blood. What blood product should I be giving, and is there a certain ratio to give it in?
If I didn't have whole blood, I would prefer to have, you know, the 1:1:1. And that's not always possible either. You know, platelets are sometimes hard to come by. So I'll just say we don't have platelets, and then I have RBCs and plasma. I think that's great. And if I didn't have one, if I only had to choose one of those, like say you can only take one with you, and we're doing, and this is trauma resuscitation, I believe I would take plasma over RBCs. And my thought on that is that we, for a long time, if you look at the, you know, the stuff that, came out of the PROPER study, that they did show that 1:1:1 had better outcomes than even 1:1:2, and we use a lot less crystalloid. Historically, we've always kind of give a little bit of crystalloid and give them some RBCs, and I think we contribute to overall to coagulopathy, to the and to some, probably some of the hypothermia associated with acute traumatic coagulopathy and the lethal triad. But I think if we give them plasma first, what we are doing there is, one, we're kind of attenuating that coagulopathy, right? So we're having some of this bleeding issues because we're using up some fibrinogen, using up a lot of the other clotting factors. So if we can give maybe a little bit of plasma, we can maybe replace some of those clotting factors. We also get a little bit of intravascular increase in our blood pressure, so we get a little bit of volume replacement with that, and overall, like I said, if we can create that clot, and we can also carry more of the oxygen we still have in our blood. I mean, people are anemic for a really long time. Like, people live being anemic, but yet they still are able to carry, you know, oxygen to their tissues. So if we can pull some of that plasma in there and give that, you know, get those RBCs circulating that are left in the body to deliver the oxygen, then maybe we could, you know, have a little bit better outcomes. That's if I had to choose one product only. Preferably, it would be 1:1:1. And if not, I would definitely start off with plasma first resuscitation.
I've noticed that becoming more and more of a thing is this plasma first resuscitation. I like the way you spell that, because it makes sense why to do that versus the packed red blood cells, which historically, of course, you know, it's, oh, give 1 to 2 units, we'll ship on their way, and we'll let the next place deal with it. If you're in a rural setting like mine, or you're just somewhere in an outlying center where trauma goes somewhere else, and we don't think anything more of it, you know, or what we do is we do the massive transfusion protocols, and those shops that have it, what do they bring first? They bring a whole bunch of O negative or O positive packed red blood cells, and then we're still waiting 30 minutes before someone brings us any plasma, if we're lucky. And then the platelets, they always forget to do the platelets, which a lot of places, it seems like we have the six-pack platelets. So usually we're way down the line of massive transfusion before we even get platelets on board.
Yeah, and I kind of explain it to also like this, is that you can oxygenate the blood all you want, but if you're not clotting, you're just going to be spilling those red blood cells out onto the floor. Make an effort to at least control the hemorrhage first, and then kind of restore maybe some of that oxygen debt.
All right, so here's the real tricky question. Are you using IV fluids at all, and if so, why?
In the first couple hours of a trauma resuscitation, if you have the capabilities, I don't really see a reason to use any crystalloid. I mean, I think you have to use some crystalloid, obviously, if you're doing 1:1:1, because you do have to, those RBCs can be pretty viscous. But whole blood, I don't see a reason to use any crystalloid in the first few hours.
So the only reason why I'm doing it is to get medications in. So sure. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like, you know, for example, calcium, which, do you still need to give calcium with whole blood?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you know, calcium, tranexamic acid, and then any other medications that go with it, such as antibiotics. I mean, that's pretty much the only time that I'm trying to do any sort of crystalloid fluids. But beyond that, I'm trying to stick with blood products. You know, you either get blood or you're not bad enough that you need anything like that.
Yeah. And I think that's great. I think we need more people thinking along those lines of, eliminate as much of the crystalloid as possible from these trauma resuscitations.
Yeah, I don't know why it's taking us so long to grasp this. I think part of it is just tradition. Part of it is because of, and I don't want to finger point at any organization, but they are doing it and they do advocate for it. But ATLS obviously does it. I'm glad that they've gone down to the one liter, but mm-hmm. I think no liters would be better in saying give blood products whenever possible would be the better way to say that. But that's just me. And we're going to have a whole separate ATLS series coming up here shortly. But or I should just say trauma management in general, not just ATLS. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, outside of that, really, we need to use the blood products. I mean, if the person's bad enough that they need something to be replaced volume-wise or clotting or whatever else, it's blood products. It's not just giving them a bunch of fluids.
I think there's a good line by Dr. Andre Kapp. He is a hematologist in the Army. And really kind of summed it all up, I believe, when it comes to crystalloids. And I'll read it to you here. So he says, the historic role of crystalloid and colloid solutions in trauma resuscitation represents the triumphant hope and wishful thinking over physiology and experience.
So one more thing, Andy, and I almost forgot to ask about it, is you mentioned calcium. We mentioned calcium about giving it. But when and how much calcium should we be giving in our trauma patients?
There are a couple studies out there that have demonstrated that there is mortality associated with trauma patients who receive massive transfusion, and they have become hypocalcemic. There has started to become a push to give calcium much sooner than the traditional, like after every 4 units. Right now, I recommend giving, 1 to 2 grams of calcium. This is for the pre-hospital setting, obviously, but giving 1 to 2 grams of calcium after the first unit. I suspect that the benefit that comes from that is it outweighs the risk of becoming hypercalcemic in the whole transition and continued blood product administration.
So you're just giving it basically up front and then not after? I just want to make sure.
Yeah. So we're kind of giving it up front after the first unit or maybe after the first 2 units, but really trying to concentrate on giving it really early because there is that mortality associated with hypocalcemia and massive transfusion patients.
Okay. And does it matter if, say, I have a bad trauma patient, really bad. I'm 6 units deep of each. You know, I've done the 1-to-1-to-1. I've gone through my 6-pack of platelets. I've given 6 units of blood. I've given 6 units of fresh frozen plasma. Do I need to start thinking about giving some more calcium?
I think so. I think we probably need to make calcium part of the vital signs as far as when we're checking the H&H, maybe we're checking the lactate, or these labs we constantly check, maybe you got a Rotem or TEG, maybe you're starting to look at calcium. So what's our calcium looking at right now and trying to aim towards, maintaining some sort of normalcy in our calcium levels.
One final part with the calcium, just because I find it so interesting. Are you doing this push? Or are you doing this more over like a drip fashion? How are you delivering the 1 to 2?
Really? However you can get it. What is most convenient for you? What is safest for you? We know that chloride, calcium chlorides, can be a little caustic in the peripheral lines. So certainly trying to be careful with how we administer calcium. However you can make it work. We have talked about, is it possible to put TXA and calcium in the same bag and just kind of let it run in? I don't see why not.
Okay, so they are compatible. We can hopefully avoid giving too many IV fluids, going back to our last thing. So while you're putting that TXA in that bag of fluids, go ahead, throw a couple of grams of calcium in with it, let it drip in, and I assume in a different line than obviously our red blood cells are going through.
Yeah, wherever our whole blood's going in one, let's put our TXA and calcium in another line and run it in. I don't see anything that says it can't be done. And this has been kind of a little bit of discussion that's been going on for a few months now. I don't think anyone has been able to identify a reason that you couldn't do it.
Anything else you want to add with blood products or doing whole blood or anything else along those lines?
I don't think so. I think it's definitely on its way out to the more rural facilities. And I would hope people would just be kind of open-minded to the possibilities of it and trying to find ways to make it work for their system.
Sounds great. So speaking of trying to do outreach, obviously something very big that you've been doing recently has been all about Stop the Bleed. And this is an incredible program, but it's one I think a lot of people don't fully recognize or appreciate yet. And you have a pretty important role on this, and this is how we kind of got really talking to each other. So can you explain a little bit about what Stop the Bleed is and how we can do our part to help?
Yeah, absolutely. So Stop the Bleed, I will first say that I am the chairman of National Stop the Bleed Month and National Stop the Bleed Day, which is a little different than the Stop the Bleed program. So, if you look at back to 2012, had the Sandy Hook shooting, and kind of out of that came the Hartford Consensus. And that kind of helped identify how to survive during active shooter situations and how to, treat massive hemorrhage. We also saw kind of coming out of President Obama, the presidential directive for national preparedness. And this is all kind of helped create this Stop the Bleed initiative. And it kind of has stakeholders from American College of Surgeons, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, and even for support from like ASAP. And overall, what happened is this kind of transformed into what is now called the Stop the Bleed program. And essentially, it's ran by the American College of Surgeons. It's on bleedingcontrol.org. And it is a one-hour course that is designed to help teach bystanders how to identify and treat those life-threatening limb and extremity hemorrhage, and kind of how to act activate 911, and then obviously apply either a tourniquet or maybe apply hemostatic dressing or apply direct pressure to these wounds until the EMS arrives and can take over.
Thank you for outlining the program and outlining Stop the Bleed Month. So what can we do to help?
All right. Yeah. So as the chairman for National Stop the Bleed Month, what we really do, and I failed to kind of maybe get to this point, was that as National Stop the Bleed Month, our whole goal is to bring not only students into the fold. So getting more people trained is obviously a huge goal of ours. But we'd also like to do is ensure that we're bringing more people to teach people how to do this. And this is where I think medical professionals, especially people who work in emergency medicine and pre-hospital medicine, can have a huge impact because they have the ability to really interact with people in some of their most, defining moments, and here we are out talking to them on a daily basis. And we have the ability to really influence the way that community can react to situations. And I don't like to use, use this language like, oh, it's going to be an active shooter situation. That's very unlikely, statistically speaking. What's more likely is going to be traffic accidents, home accidents, at school or at work that are going to cause this life-threatening hemorrhage. So here we have the ability to maybe go at and teach our community how to save a life if someone that you may know. And that's really our goal, is to bring students and more instructors into the fold. So what your listeners can do and what, I try to get people to do is to go to bleedingcontrol.org and register as an instructor and then look for courses to teach or, create courses of your own to teach and try to make a bigger impact within your society and within your community.
Thanks, Andy. And actually, just for, again, people who are listening, I think we take advantage a lot of our situation. We don't think about it the same way. We think, like you said, oh, an active shooter situation that, of course, that everyone says will never happen here. And then, of course, it does. But the more common incidents, I mean, I can think of the last couple of times, the last few months, where I've had patients that came in by ambulance with tourniquets on, even in one or two cases, people coming from home with their own homemade versions of tourniquets, usually belts, and because of all sorts of accidents. And actually, one of the most common is those with related to farming or industry, such as, you know, tractor injuries or from chainsaws, because it's that time of year too where people start busting out the chainsaws again. But everything seems to happen all the time with these, where we get a lot of people who are exposed that we wouldn't normally think about. And another layer of confusion and complication with this is when we're talking about people in our settings. I mean, when I was working a lot more on the truck and where I was working at, it was about an hour to the closest hospital in most cases. So if you have someone who's out in the field like this, especially if it can take 30 minutes or so for you to even get to the scene, good first aid by those who are there, including sometimes the patient themselves knowing how to do this, is very key to survival.
Absolutely. You know, we try to instill that you can bleed out from, you know, one of the major arteries in roughly 5 minutes. And the average EMS response time, even in urban settings, isn't that fast. So especially in rural settings, it's really important that people understand that is basics of hemorrhage control. You know, if they can't, we train people to use the commercially available tourniquets that are recommended by the Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care. But if they don't have a tourniquet, how to pack a wound, how to apply that direct pressure in order to control that hemorrhage until someone can get there that can maybe is a little bit better prepared to treat it.
Thanks, Andy. Anything else you wanted to add on that?
I don't think so. We have Facebook page. We have National Stop the Bleed Month. Our website is stopthebleedmonth.org. But if you want to learn more about specifically about the Stop the Bleed program, it's at bleedingcontrol.org.
And of course, you should plug your own Facebook page too, because I enjoy looking at it.
I don't run the page. I know the guys who do.
Oh, really? And I didn't realize that.
No, I don't run it. Good group of guys. I kind of help provide a little bit of oversight because, it's my face on there. So
quite literally,
the St. Fisher Church of Evidence-Based Medicine. So it's quite funny with, these kids are really smart, really funny, and, put out these just really smart memes that, kind of get you thinking a little bit about, you know, how we practice medicine.
Okay, so we had to back up for just a second because I did not realize that you didn't really have involvement with this. So who is doing this? You've got me so much more intrigued now.
It's a group of paramedics and EMTs that I just have gotten to know over social media. And I guess it says something to the how much I kind of maybe whine and moan about evidence and such on social media that they went ahead and kind of made a parody of me.
Well, it is humorous. Check it out for sure, because it does. They still get good information across, even though it is in many ways a parody. But I like that. But obviously the big thing, Stop the Bleed. You know, we want to check that out. Do our part for this as well. I know more and more I'm getting, we see in the airports, casinos, so on and so forth, places in the public eye, and I think even more so it needs to be starting in the schools too, where we have AEDs, right? But right next to the AED, and maybe even the same box, I don't care how it's done, but we need to have the hemorrhage control stuff right with it.
I think that's critical that's what we also need to push from, what we expect from our public officials is to outline ways to get these into these public places. So absolutely.
Yeah. And I'll try and include in the show notes too, a picture where I was very excited. I was at an airport and I saw the AED and right beside it was hemorrhage control. And that was the first time that I'd seen that properly. And it was in an airport, but why not do it? And like I said, in the schools, because I know, you know, everything costs money, like stick an EpiPen, stick hemorrhage control, and then put the AED all right in the same spot.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that hard. I know there's a cost associated with it, but it's for some reason, it's very difficult for us to still get people outside of, you know, medicine interested in stop the bleed. It's sometimes hard for people to get people in medicine interested in the stop the bleed and bleeding control.
Well, hopefully those listening can start recognizing that we need to do this and can help out in their part too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so.
I guess it's about that time, Andy. Can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.